so this memo really struck me as showing her tremendous influence over the arc of the LBJ presidency and his enormous reliance and trust of her and her judgment.
That's Julia Swag, and I'm Dan Skinner. This is Conversations. Julia Swag is an award-winning author of books on Cuba, Latin America, and American foreign policy. She served as a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations for 15 years, and she's a senior research fellow at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. She joins us to talk about her book, Lady Bird Johnson, Hiding in Plain Sight. She also hosts a podcast about Lady Bird Johnson, which we'll learn about in just a few minutes. Julia, welcome to the program.
Dan, I'm delighted to be here with you.
Well, before we sample some of the information you have to share in this book about Lady Bird, give us an overview of what readers will find here.
This Lady Bird Johnson, Hiding in Plain Sight, tells the story of what I think of as the other LBJ, a woman of extraordinary influence and power within the LBJ presidency and with her husband, Lyndon Johnson. And it focuses mainly on the White House years. And the book is based in large part on the archival holdings in the LBJ library and many other archives around the country, but most especially the audio diaries that Lady Bird Johnson herself recorded starting 8 days after the Kennedy assassination in 1963, all the way through the end of January 1969, 123 hours of audio recording documenting her experience during those White House years.
Now, what strikes me, and I assume is part of the reason you wrote the book, is most people are not aware of how strong she was in terms of her ability to strategize, her political savvy. One wonders if LBJ would have been nearly as successful in politics without her.
100% you're correct that my motivation to write this derived from just being so taken aback at how massively her story has been missed in the telling of the LBJ story and that of his presidency especially. And of course, to find this unexcavated material that completely upsets the apple cart about our understanding of that presidency and that decade was extremely compelling for me.
There are many examples which you present in the book, but one that impressed me was Lady Bird Johnson's analysis of whether or not LBJ should run for re-election. Tell us about that.
Yes, I found in the LBJ library a folder that was labeled Letters Mrs. Johnson to President Johnson. And in that was a 9-page handwritten on stenography paper analysis, a pro and con memo that she wrote to Lyndon Johnson in May of 1964. They'd only been in office since November of 63, of course. And at that point in time, we're looking ahead to the November 1964 presidential election. And LBJ was miserable and full of self-doubt about whether, even if he won, he would be able to unite the country and keep it united. His civil rights legislation was jammed in the Congress. The war on poverty legislation hadn't yet passed. And he was feeling immense pressure over Vietnam, pressure to escalate, and uncertain about how he could avoid getting sucked in. So he asked Lady Bird to lay out an analysis, a pro and con analysis of whether he should run or whether he should step out. And she did so, and she laid out the argument that he should run again, he should run, period, and that in February or March of 1968, he could then announce to the country that he would not be running for a second term, which of course is precisely what he did. So this memo really struck me as showing her tremendous influence over the arc of the LBJ presidency and his enormous reliance and trust of her and her judgment. So that's just one example. There are many more.
I'm curious about what you were able to learn about Lady Bird's feelings about politics. Obviously, she was very savvy, but how did she feel about being involved in that world?
Well, initially when she met LBJ in the 1930s and learned that he was, you know, he was a congressional staffer when she met him, and it became pretty evident during their courtship that he wanted to get into elected office himself, and she was quite unhappy about that, didn't want that life. But by the second or third time he ran for office, especially his Senate run in 1948, by then she was all in. And she started to live in Washington, D.C., and by the time he gets to be majority leader in 1955 of the Senate, she's a political animal through and through, and she is comfortable on the rope line, fundraising, constituent services. She ran his congressional office when he was in the Pacific and in California during World War II. She was top to bottom his political partner. You asked me how she felt about it. I think she felt that it was, that it became her calling because they were totally intertwined with one another. Initially, that wasn't her feeling, but by the end, I think she couldn't have imagined an alternative, and yet she was very happy to leave Washington and the White House once they did get out and to get back to some kind of more reliable family life.
You know, first ladies traditionally take on causes during their time in the White House. What were the causes that Lady Bird championed?
Well, the major cause that we associate with her, and this was part of my just delight in discovering how much more there was to this woman, was, of course, what was called beautification. And she hated that word. And what it concealed was a very progressive and ambitious environmental agenda. She didn't really pick it up until after he was installed in office on his own accord in 1965, and then began an evolution of what I think of as going from the ornamental to the fundamental. She started with what we understand as the planting of flowers, especially over Washington, D.C., in the touristy areas of the city, the white areas of the city, and of course the Highway Beautification Act, which was about what it sounds like, although a more substantial challenge to the auto and billboard and junkyard industry than is understood. But her environmentalism took a turn by the end of 1965, early 1966, where she was really trying, especially in Washington, as a model for the rest of the country, to bring together civil rights, great society values, and what we think of as environmental justice today, especially for the majority residents of Washington, D.C., who didn't have easy, desegregated access to nature, and for whom she was most focused on making that possible. So Washington becomes her test case, and she teamed up with some really interesting philanthropists and landscape architects and urban planners who were reeling from the effects of urban renewal around the country and wanted to try to deploy federal funds, desegregate access to nature for those most underserved by, in this case, the city of D.C., the District of Columbia.
You point out that Lady Bird Johnson was very powerful behind the scenes. That's a story that most of us don't know. But I'm curious about those she worked with and interacted with during her time in the White House. Were they aware of the power she was wielding, and how did they react to it?
Well, I think it was mixed. Those that were closest to the two LBJs were entirely aware of it. And those that were less accustomed to that kind of intertwined political partnership were taken aback. Some of the Kennedy holdovers, for example, who stayed on with LBJ in the first year or so after he came into the White House, were quite alienated and just downright sexist about Lady Bird's influence, and in particular the way she and her chief of staff, another extraordinary woman, Liz Carpenter, worked with LBJ to knit together a joint political operation between the East Wing and the West Wing. And one of the things, Dan, that I've found as this book has come out and I've had an opportunity to talk about it with more and more people is that many of the individuals who were around LBJ, who knew about her influence and how important she was to him as a strategist and advisor, have now been talking more publicly about what they observed while they were in the White House. And part of that has to just do with, I think this book liberating people to be more open about it.
Well, one of the things I wanted to mention that in addition to the text, you have a section of photographs. Could you describe some of the photos that people will see?
I'll tell you, you know, one of the great things about the LBJ Library is the photo archive there. So there are about 32 photographs in the inside part of the book, but I think we must have pulled that from 3,000 initially that we culled through, because the photo documentation of her life in politics and in Washington is just immense. So we start with Lady Bird up on Capitol Hill, which she and Lyndon described as their home. And it ends with Lady Bird reflecting on how she felt during the turmoil and tragedy of the Vietnam War. And throughout, what you see is her being the political animal that she was, on the rope lines in campaigning in the South with Jackie Kennedy during the 1960 campaign, then going on to show her in various different settings where she was, whether on the environment or even, for example, helping to acquire the Hirshhorn art collection for the Smithsonian. The imagery shows a ladybird that I think people aren't used to seeing, the two-dimensional kind of, you know, more traditional First Lady's stand by her man imagery is not what we show here. What we show here is her protagonism and her agency and her activism.
I'm curious, you mentioned the campaign, and of course, there was that time that LBJ was vice president. What was Lady Bird Johnson's take on Jackie and the Kennedys and their relationship during that time?
Well, the Jackie Kennedy Lady Bird Johnson relationship really intrigued me because it has some length to it. You know, in the 50s, when Lady Bird is the senior Senate spouse because Lyndon is Senate Majority Leader, Jackie and Jack come into Washington and Jack gets elected first to the House and then to the Senate. And Jackie's about 20 years younger than Lady Bird, and Lady Bird really attempts to draw Jackie into the political scene that the Senate spouses are part of. Jackie's not that into it, but they both have a kind of gentle mutual regard for one another. And that continues throughout the decade. But in 1960, of course, the power dynamics shift. And as you mentioned, the Johnsons take the vice presidential slot on the 1960 ticket, which is really hard for them to swallow. Jackie is pregnant, has dealing with miscarriages for many years, and so Lady Bird goes out on the campaign trail as her surrogate and campaigns all over the country for Jackie, travels with Eunice and Rose Kennedy and the other sisters and sisters-in-law, and wins Texas for JFK, as Bobby noted. So the standing that Lady Bird has with the Kennedys once they enter the White House is huge. And then as second lady, she continues to stand in and show up for Jackie. So by the time the assassination comes around, Jackie has a really kind of adoring and high regard for Lady Bird. And the two of them negotiate and navigate in the 14 days between the assassination and when Jackie and the kids move out of the White House and the Johnsons move in, this excruciating and graceful transition. And I was able to read about that, especially in the diaries that Lady Bird kept, but also in the oral histories that each of them gave, where you see just how the tenderness between the two of them then evolved to a kind of tension once, especially Bobby Kennedy's political aspirations became so clear in terms of his entrance into politics in first as senator from New York and then getting into the presidential mix as well. So the Jackie Lady Bird relationship becomes a lot more tense, and then they recover it well down the line in the 1980s when they start to see one another again.
Well, we've just touched the surface of what's in this book. Julia, I'm curious, what do you see as the legacy of Lady Bird Johnson?
Wonderful question. First and foremost, I would say that her choice to document her time in the White House, Dan, again, a woman who was of another era, but who really understood and had a high self-regard for her participation in LBJ's presidency and entire career. Her choice to do that as First Lady, I think, is one of the most important legacies she's left us, because it is a contemporaneous documentary record by such an important member of the Johnson administration. So that's number one. I say that as a historian, and hope that other people, other first ladies, first gentlemen today and down the road will do the same. The second is her environmentalism really helped to seed the public consciousness to produce very quickly after the Johnsons left a slew of environmental regulations and policies under the Nixon administration, including the creation of the EPA, the celebration of the first Earth Day, and the beginnings of a discussion, which I think is much more robust now, about access to nature for all Americans as a key part of our democratic heritage and civic duty. Those are just three off the top of my head. There are half a dozen more, but I know that we're running out of time.
Well, to learn more, there is the book, Lady Bird Johnson, Hiding in Plain Sight by Julia Swag. Julia also hosts a podcast series with a similar title, In Plain Sight, Lady Bird Johnson. Julia, tell us about it.
Well, again, back to these audio tapes, 123 hours of audio. To me, as I was finishing this book, Dan, I just realized this is a story that needs to be heard as well, because Lady Bird's accounts are very rich to listen to. She's got that gorgeous East Texas lilt. She has an incredible command of words and paints beautiful word pictures, cogent sentences, perfectly constructed paragraphs, and she captures so much drama and emotion. You know, she tells us the story of three political assassinations, civil rights, Vietnam. It's all in there. So I teamed up with a wonderful production company called Best Case Studios, and we decided to put together a proposal, which we then brought to ABC News, which picked it up, and ABC News and Best Case, with me as the narrator and executive producer, produced an 8-episode, I think of it as an audio documentary, because it's not conversational to what we're doing right now. It's a deep dive with Lady Bird's audio, my narration, and all kinds of contemporaneous archival material. And we have a cast of characters that includes the Kennedys and Eartha Kitt and Richard Nixon and Woody Allen and Alfred Hitchcock and Harry Belafonte and all kinds of other people, plus newscasts of the time. I commend it to anyone who maybe wants to digest this story differently than reading the book, or you know, you're welcome to listen to it and read the book as well. But it really does give a kind of richness and dimension that I hope the writing achieved, but that this adds immeasurably to, I think.
Again, the book is Lady Bird Johnson, Hiding in Plain Sight by Julia Swag. Julia, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Dan. Thanks for having me.
You'll find more interviews on a wide variety of topics at kansaspublicradio.org/conversations. You can use the KPR app to listen on your phone or tablet. You can sign up for the Conversations podcast on iTunes, and you'll also find us on Facebook. Conversations is a production of Kansas Public Radio. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.